Good afternoon and welcome to your weekly edition of The Wrap. I'm Travis Fain, WRL Statehouse reporter.
I'm Brian Anderson, also a Statehouse reporter.
Yeah, that's right. We have expanded the team here at WRAL in NC Capital. No one's leaving. We're bringing more people in. Brian's new, joined us from the Associated Press. Jack Hagel is our editor. He is also new at WRAL. And we thought we'd take a minute here. Brian, you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself and where are you coming from here?
Yeah, so I came from the Sacramento Bee over in California, and I joined the Associated Press just in 2020. And I have some previous experience covering North Carolina politics as I'm an Elon University alum. And I'm happy to be here with WRAL, achieving my lifelong goal of covering North Carolina politics full time.
Yeah, we got one guy who lifelong goal of covering North Carolina politics, and then another guy who won't stop complaining about it. We should make quite the odd couple here. One day of legislative session this week on, I guess it was Wednesday, they met and quickly approved House Bill 605. That's the one that again delays primary elections. Good chance the governor vetoes it. But I mean, basically, Brian, they're moving the elections from May, where the Supreme Court put them, to June. Is it June 7th?
It's all over the place. It was May 17th. And now it is June 7th, unless the governor vetoes the bill, as many people expect him to, in which case it stays May 17th, but we also have some Supreme Court complications that can mess things up even more.
Yeah, the Supreme Court could very well move it again, right? They could look at the exact same problem that Republicans are looking at in the legislature, this kind of real compact schedule and not a lot of time to get done what needs to get done, and the Supreme Court could change the election date. As well, the issue is arguments are February 2nd in the ongoing redistricting case. Then we have to have time to redraw the maps. State law requires the court, if it wants to redraw those maps, to give the legislature at least 14 days to do so. And then you start to run into a difficulty at the State Board of Elections level, where you have to have time for candidates to file. They have to know what districts they're filing in. And then you've got to start sending absentee ballots out pretty early in North Carolina. So you very quickly run into a time crunch issue.
Right. I mean, February 18th is the date that the State Board of Elections has said, if we're going with our current May 17th schedule, this is when we need to have these maps finalized. And the concern Republicans have is, like you said, February 2nd, you get 2 weeks to redraw. That doesn't leave you with much time, even if the Supreme Court makes a decision the exact same day it hears the case, which isn't happening. So a lot of factors at play for sure.
Yeah, and we've also got, as we kind of head toward that February 2nd date, that's when oral arguments are in this case. We've been talking about recusals. Some people want people recused. Some people don't want justices to recuse. I saw today that the League of Conservation Voters, which is a plaintiff in this case, said, I just let all the judges hear it, but Republicans have asked for two Democratic members of the Supreme Court to recuse, and then some of the plaintiffs have asked for one Republican justice to recuse. Tell us a little bit about that.
Anita Earls, Sam Ervin, those are the two Democratic registered justices on the Supreme Court that the Republicans want to take off of this redistricting case. Phil Berger Jr., he is the Republican that the Democrats and the voting rights groups want to take off the case. They cite conflicts of interest or perceived conflicts of interest being enough to not give the public confidence that they should be allowed to make a ruling and be involved in this case.
Yeah, and the argument on Ervin is he's the only one up for re-election this year. And the argument against Justice Earls is, of course, she was a civil rights attorney, has brought redistricting and voter ID cases before. And Eric Holder's group, I can't remember the name of the redistricting association for Democrats nationally, but it's run by Eric Holder. It was a major donor, kind of in a circuitous route, but not all that circuitous, into Justice Earls' campaign. So Republicans are really pushing hard against her hearing this case, because Holder's group is helping fund these cases across the country. And I mean, it's all kind of part of one sort of partisan effort, you know, Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other. And then of course, Phil Berger Jr. is Phil Berger Sr.'s son. So it's interesting how kind of replete with potential conflicts of interest are our state Supreme Court. For seven people, they've really ticked a lot of boxes.
And for Anita Earls in particular, she was with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice back not terribly far long ago. And those are one of the groups that are challenging these redrawn maps. So Republicans are saying, how can a former leader of this group objectively hear a case involving that group? And Phil Berger Sr. is listed as a defendant in this case. So hard to maybe judge a father if you're one of the Democrats saying, can he make a fair assessment on this case?
Yeah, and if you're looking to read the tea leaves, I think it would be toward none of the justices recusing themselves. They were asked to do so, a couple of Republican justices, Berger and then Justice Tamara Berenger, were asked to recuse in an earlier voter ID case and declined to do so. And the court said, as a court, it's going to be up to them. It's not going to be anything where there's going to be a forced recusal. So that's where we're headed with that. Before we move on from the one-day session this week, I want to mention that you might have heard Speaker of the House Tim Moore. His voice didn't sound so good. He sounded sick from the rostrum. His spokesperson says he had a negative COVID test. So, you know, if you're wondering what that meant, that he sounded quite hoarse from the dais there. That's what they say. He had a negative COVID test, but was feeling, and I quote, just a little bit under the weather. So, Brian, you've got a piece that has just hit Friday afternoon on the NCCapitol.com. It's about the governor and kind of this shifting idea of how to respond to the pandemic, and particularly when it comes to forced shutdowns.
Well, let's think back to what the governor has said consistently throughout the course of this pandemic. If I had a nickel for every time I heard that everything's on the table, I might not be a wealthy man, but I'd at least hopefully have a couple of dollars in my pocket. Well, that's something we've heard frequently. We've also heard data is driving the decision-making process. These are things that have been repeated by Cooper himself and his administration officials. And we're hearing a little bit less of that right now. What we're seeing instead is comments from Cooper saying that we're going to have to live with this virus and that we want to reach an endemic stage of this virus where we can coexist with it. And one of the interesting things that came up in my reporting was just comparing the time that these mandates were in place. You'll remember the statewide mask mandate. People couldn't go to bars and restaurants. Schools were closed. There was outdoor gathering limits. And during that time, cases, hospitalizations, substantially less than they are today.
Yeah, and I mean, the vaccine is what they'll point to and say, that's what's really different here, is that we've got everyone who's over at least, I guess, 5 years old has had pretty well had time to vaccinate. That seems to be helping a lot, keep people out of the hospital largely. No one really expected Omicron, but I mean, perhaps left unsaid is that these restrictions, they only work if people accept them. You know, you cannot police a state of 10 million people into a lockdown effectively in this country, and the will just isn't there for them. And so while it's obviously that there's been a change in strategy because of the vaccines, I think there's also, I don't know if you want to call that a political angle to it or not, but there's only so much that you can do. And it's not like the lockdowns have this really successful track record of stopping the virus in its tracks, or we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
And it's worth noting the North Carolina Healthcare Association, the North Carolina Nurses Association, neither of these two people, these two organizations are asking the governor to take a statewide mandate action or reimpose previous restrictions. One interesting thing is back July 30th, there was the statewide mask mandate was in effect. As you'll remember, cases were very low in June. The positivity rate back then in the month of July reached as low as 2.5%. And the statewide mask mandate was in place at that time. We're now at a level where it's 34%. And you can remember that it's July. Presumably anyone who wants a vaccine could have been fully vaccinated by that point.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. Masks became much more controversial than I think, at least I expected, but I mean, what do I know? I'll mention real quickly, I had a story run yesterday. The state is going to change how it helps folks with disabilities work in the community. Right now, there's about 1,000 people in the state. They work in what's called sheltered workshops. These are kind of large-ish business areas where you get the folks with disabilities congregate. They do fairly simple little jobs, repetitive work. It pays almost nothing, apparently. I was surprised to find that people make as little as like $100 a month, $10 a week. What we're going to do, the state is has been under pressure and is now changing that. These still subsidized jobs are going to be with what you would think of more as a regular business, an ice cream shop, a bookstore, something like that. People are going to be working more community jobs, and they will pay at least minimum wage. And that's something that this community has worked for a long time. There was a class action suit in Oregon that kind of got this started, but apparently North Carolina is somewhat at the forefront on that. You can go read about that on nccapital.com. I will also mention a story, Laura Leslie, who is doing some digital work today. So Brian's pinch hitting for her here. She's got a story. There are too many bears, apparently, in Western North Carolina. We've got several sanctuaries, three that she mentioned particularly. And the idea was to let's help bears, you know, reproduce in these sanctuaries. Apparently worked quite well. And there are more bears now, but also more humans in the area too. You know, the humanity's march to live and be and impact everywhere on this planet continues. And that, of course, is leading to what government calls negative human-bear interactions, which probably isn't as bad as it sounds. But
I'm trying to recall the last positive bear-human interaction someone has had.
Yeah, I guess if you get a selfie and don't get mauled, that is a positive. No, I think some of it simply has to do with if a bear goes through your backpack for food, that counts. Anyway, read that story. The Wildlife Resources Commission is proposing to open these three bear sanctuaries out west to limited hunting in the fall of 2022. Public comment period, it will last for the entirety of this year. Excuse me, until the end of this month. My apologies. And then in February, the State Wildlife Resource Commission will vote. I kind of forgot what year it was there for a minute, Brian. I hope no one will blame me for that.
I don't think so. We have a very forgiving audience.
Speaking of calendars, next week, I haven't looked fully at it. I do know that I believe on Tuesday, the legislature's kind of off-season oversight committee looking at COVID spending in the state meets. They've had a series of meetings. Not sure what exactly they're going to be looking at, but that's something we always pay attention to. And we'll continue to next week. Brian, you got anything else to flag for the good people?
One thing I probably should flag is we had a really interesting state worker story just about the vaccination rates of these state workers being low, particularly for Department of Transportation workers and for Department of Public Safety workers, these prison officials. And now these prison officials are getting incentives of, I think, north of $250 to try and get the vaccine. It might be 500. I'll have to check that. But you can read that, WREL.com, and you might want to stay tuned. There could be a follow-up to that story later this weekend.
All right. Well, we'll look out for that. And, of course, we'll be back at you as appropriate next week. We're probably going to remain in a kind of weekly wrap posture, but we'll keep you caught up as best we can here on The Wrap.